Blog Talk Radio.
Howdy, y'all. You punk beans. How's everybody doing today? Got a full show for you. Yeah, yeah, yeah. This is my song. I'm singing the full show song. There was, like, no rhythm to that. There was no, like, wow, that was terrible. Okay, a lot of stuff to get to. We have a new poll on different aspects of healthcare, and the American people are putting the largest middle finger in the world up to the Republicans. We're going to talk about that. We have an MSNBC contributor continues to make excuses. Oh, my goodness, please stop it for Hillary Clinton and her loss. Stop, stop. Afghanistan got an update on the war, which nobody fucking talks about. And then a Fox doctor doesn't know his ass from his elbow. He does one of the worst segments I've ever seen on healthcare. And later on in the show, I'll hit you with some substance over the head because California's right to die law has now been in effect for a while, and we have some stats, some numbers, some facts about it. So I think all that is very, very important. Let's go ahead and get started here, and we're going to do that with the Quinnipiac poll. This is a great poll because it gives you a little bit of insight into what the American people really think on the issue of healthcare. New Quinnipiac poll out on a variety of issues, and it has some powerful results. So I just want to run through some of it with you here. This is going to focus on healthcare. So they ask... agreement, blah, 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 blah. Okay, I suck at this. All right, try that again. I got to get it right. New Quinnipiac poll on a variety of issues in regards to healthcare, and it has some powerful results. So here, let's run through some of it. What percentage of Americans agree with President Trump's handling of healthcare? Just 29%. That's abysmally low. Okay, but it gets even crazier. How many Americans want a full repeal of Obamacare? Just 9% want a full repeal. So the position that is the go-to position in the so-called Freedom Caucus, which is the Tea Partiers, which is the far-right caucus in the House, only 9% of Americans approve of that. Okay, how about Trump Care's approval rating? 16%. It lost a percentage point, the House version to the Senate version. Now only 16% approve it. Before it was 17%. This is a comically sad bill. More. How many Americans think Trump Care would decrease health insurance costs? So one of the main things that's like, okay, we're doing a reform for our system, like one of the positive results that you'd want that goes hand in hand with that is a decrease in insurance costs. That's like one of the big ones. What percentage of Americans think that'll actually happen? 10%. Okay, this piece of legislation is universally despised. Universally. Okay, more. How many Americans support cutting Planned Parenthood, federal funding for Planned Parenthood? Just 35%. You would think with all the Republican yelps about that, that that would be like 50%, like half the country. All the Republicans would say, yeah, we got to get rid. Nope, 35%. What percentage of Americans support cutting Medicaid? 24%. And the best part, the most important part, what percentage of Americans support Medicare for All? 60%. At this point, it's every poll. It's every poll. When you ask the American people about Medicare for All, it's 60% or more. I've seen 60% and I've seen 61% in recent times. Everything the Democrats need to know about healthcare policy is laid out in this Quinnipiac poll. Every single thing. So, first of all, you should be absolutely ruthless and flat out vicious in your attacks on Republicans over Trump care. Because it's already the case that nobody likes Trump care. Everybody despises it. So get your factual talking points down. So it's about $800 billion in Medicaid cuts. It's a giant tax cut to the rich where I think everybody in the top 1% or 2% gets an extra $200,000 a year. Wow. You have premiums that go up for a 64-year-old with middle income. Their premiums go from like $6,000 to $28,000. So get all your ducks in a row. Get all your factual talking points down about how shitty this bill is. You now have a waiver for protections for pre-existing conditions if the states want it, and the Republican states are going to want it. So think about that. That's wild, man. Like, oh, if you're in Kentucky, you don't have protection for pre-existing conditions. Right, because they don't need it in Kentucky. They need it everywhere. Everybody needs it. So hammer away on that. Hammer away on the fact that the health insurance companies no longer have to spend 80% of their money on actual health care. That's part of Obamacare. Well, now that's basically been reversed. They've that's another one where they've given a waiver for Republican states if they want to opt out of that, and they're going to opt out of that. So get all your talking points down. Start swinging a hammer at Trump care on a daily basis. But then the other half of the picture, which so many Democrats leave out because they're not in favor of it, is you have to swing for the fences with Medicare for All, because 60% of the American people agree with Medicare for All. And that's with only like Bernie Sanders and sometimes Elizabeth Warren making the case for it. So imagine if every Democrat in the country was making the case for Medicare for All. Because it's not enough. Here's the thing. It's not enough to just say, hey, they're really shitty, or say, hey, they're really shitty, and let's defend the status quo, which is Obamacare, which is this originally conservative idea, this middle path that keeps the private health insurance companies in control, and is only about 25% of what we have to do when it comes to... So it's not enough to say, defend the status quo, defend business as usual, attack Republicans. You have to... If they're proposing something, they're proposing Trump care, you need to say, okay, that is your proposal. Ours is, you can't just say, defeat Trump care and leave it as is with Obamacare. You have to fight for something, not just against something. And the thing you have to fight for is Medicare for All. And that would be, the Democrats would cakewalk into not only the White House, but they would win across the board in terms of the Senate, the House of Representatives. But you have to actually fight for those things. You have to actually fight for them. And, you know, if you disagree, just understand you're not disagreeing with me. You're disagreeing with the people, because the numbers spell it out. And again, 60% approval rating for Medicare for All, that's with only like Bernie Sanders making the case on a regular basis. So let's go, guys. But unfortunately, the reality is many Democrats can't push for it because many Democrats are corporate Democrats, and they take money from Big Pharma. They take money from health insurance companies, so they do their bidding, which is why... Needless to say, we need a wave of justice Democrats. Okay. Now we're going to move on to the insane man baby and his tweets. You think I want to talk about this? I do not. But I have to. It is my job. So yesterday we discussed the president's insane man-baby tweets. Let me give you them one more time here. He said, I heard poorly rated Morning Joe speaks badly of me. Don't watch anymore. Then how come low IQ Crazy Mika along with Psycho Joe came to Mar-a-Lago three nights in a row around New Year's Eve and insisted on joining me? She was bleeding badly from a facelift. I said no. Most powerful man on the planet right here. This is what he's focused on. Oh my goodness, what are we going to do? We have seven different interventions going on right now. We have a healthcare fight, which is absolutely crucial. This is what he's talking about, man. Ugh. He really watches hours and hours and hours of cable news every single day. And it shows. He's obsessed with it. Well, in response to this, everybody came out against Trump. Let me give you some examples. This is the senior vice president of NBC Universal. He said, never imagined a day when I would think to myself, it is beneath my dignity to respond to the president of the United States. Yeah, fair enough. I hear you, buddy. I hear you. Okay, now we get some prominent Republican politicians. Here's Senator Lindsey Graham. Mr. President, your tweet was beneath the office and represents what is wrong with American politics, not the greatness of America. And then you have Ben Sass, or, you know, Ben Sassafras, Ben Sassy. He says, please just stop. This is another senator, by the way. This isn't normal and it's beneath the dignity of your office. So we finally found a thing where, you know, people will... Republicans will disagree with the Republican president. We found it. Tweets. Mean tweets at a cable news host. Yes, on the one hand, hey, thank you, Lindsey Graham. Thank you, Ben Sass, for stating the obvious that any reasonable person would say when it comes to, you know, personal dealings. Somebody who is the most powerful person in the world, like talking down and personally insulting a random cable news host. Like, I'm happy about that, and I wish every Republican senator and every person in the country would go, you know what, low blow, son. Come on, reel it in. But at the same time, I do find it incredibly frustrating that it requires personal level gossip bullshit that gets like strong condemnations, and you know, that's the thing that generates the outrage and the pearl clutching and the my goodness, that is in poor taste, that is not proper decorum, good sir. Like, that's what generates that. Now, meanwhile, what's happening in the country right now? The Republicans are pushing a health care bill that kicks, what, another 24 million people off health insurance? Guts Medicaid to the tune of about $800 billion? Gets rid of protections for pre-existing conditions for people? The premiums are going to shoot up for the people who need the protection the most? We have seven different interventions going on. It's every week I read a story about how President Trump is bombing somebody he shouldn't be bombing, whether it's the Syrian army who's currently fighting ISIS, whether it's innocent civilians in Yemen or Pakistan and or Iraq and various drone strikes. I mean, our infrastructure gets a grade of D+. Flint doesn't have clean water. At no point does it cross the mind of Ben Sass or Lindsey Graham to say, hey man, fucked up, you want to kick millions of people off health insurance? And no point does it cross their mind to say, hey, did you see that new study that says 28,000 more people will die if Trump care passes? Because you're kicking people off Medicaid and they're not going to get the care they need. And then people die as a result of that. There are some people who are going to die as a result of that. They never say that. They never say that. Real substantive policy effects that would, like, ruin people's lives and change families forever and just have a devastating impact across the board. That never generates, like, outrage or pearl clutching or strongly worded condemnations, because they all agree on that. They all agree on that. When it comes to being the biggest asshole in the world, policy-wise, and screwing over the American people, doing tax cuts for the rich and shifting the burden onto regular people, doing favors for corporations that do the campaign donations and ignoring your constituents. That stuff they all agree on. The broken system, which is why Congress has like a 9% approval rating on a regular basis. They all agree on that. Let's continue business as usual. Let's continue having a 9% approval rating. Let's continue this corrupt, disgusting system. Let's continue fucking people over when it comes to health care, when it comes to their wages, when it comes to foreign policy. They all agree there. But, oh my goodness, you were impolite to a cable news host in personal terms. Now you've gone too far. It just shows how we're really bad at keeping our eye on the ball. We are. We have a reality star president. We also apparently have a reality star attention span. That's the word I was looking for. I was going to say time span, but that made no sense. That's what we have. I mean, it's got to be something super like lowbrow and relatable. Like, oh, I get in fights with my friends from time to time, and we say catty things to each other. That's what they're doing. Oh, now we can relate and talk about it. Well, no. First of all, the media is responsible for driving the conversation in the country, so they should be the ones who are harping away on the policy over everything else. But they don't do that. This is the stuff that generates the headlines. And I really just think it's sad, man. I do. I obviously agree that this shows Trump is a man baby. And he's a petty man and an unintelligent man. So ironic, he's hurling accusations of other people having a low IQ, because let's be serious here, who's the one with that? So in a sense, yes, I'm happy that people, come on, man, what are you doing? But that needs to be done in areas where millions of lives are affected, and it's simply not. And in those areas, they actually agree with him, which is even more frustrating. Okay. Next, let's do a quick one, and then we'll take a first break here. Wendy Sherman is an MSNBC contributor. She was at an event called the Aspen Ideas Festival in Colorado, which I know nothing about, but on name alone, it sounds immensely douchey. And she floated a new idea as to why Hillary lost to Trump.
Hesitate to say, but I think it's critical, looking out at our audience and looking out at most of us, that there is no doubt that we just had 8 years of an African-American president is not a factor in all that we are experiencing today. Mm-hmm. When we make social change, when we make a decision to do something we have never done before, we then take two steps backwards, at least. And I believe in my bones among the list, I agree with the list that Sam put out about why Hillary lost, but I would add to that that it was pretty hard to elect a woman after you've elected the first African-American president.
Okay, hold on 1 second. She's looking for a number that I should have had before the show, but I forgot. Oh, shit. Fucking autoplay, man. I'm going to wage jihad against autoplay on websites. Okay, sorry. Anyway, where was I? She's saying that Hillary Clinton lost because Obama was black. See, this is identity politics run amok. This is the bastardization of identity politics. Yeah, you know, we had a black man as president for all those years, and then it's going to be hard to go from minority to minority, and yeah, that's real difficult, and people weren't ready for that. Why can't it just be people weren't ready for that female president, her, as an individual? Because that's what it really is. It's not like people were saying, should we go from African-American man to woman? That's not a big calculation on a large number of Americans' minds. It's just not. In fact, there were, I forget the exact number, but I do know it was incredibly high. There were millions of voters who went for Obama, and then they flipped and went for Trump. So, weird, their apparent racism didn't stop them from pulling the lever for the black man. They just didn't want to pull the lever for the female, because again, maybe they're not just voting based off of race and gender. Maybe there are other concerns and other things that go into their mind. And it's things like this that make like those Midwestern Rust Belt voters roll their eyes and just go, you're not, like, this is what you're talking about after you got your ass handed to you in an election? You're like trying to read the tea leaves and the chicken entrails and going, oh, yeah, what was it? Maybe it was the fact she's a woman. Oh, yes, the fact she has a vagina. That's the thing. Like, why? That's so arbitrary. What? Oh, what was it? Oh, it was the fact that she has the brown-colored eyes. Oh, my God, she had brown color. I don't know what color eyes Hillary Clinton has. She has blue eyes. Oh, my God, she had blue eyes. They weren't ready to vote for somebody with blue eyes. They weren't. No. Okay, Trump was so incredibly beatable. If you ran Elizabeth Warren against Trump in the last election, she would have won. I have no doubt about that. Even though as many times she pissed off progressives in a variety of different ways since, so yada, yada. She would have won. She would have beat Trump. She would have, I think, destroyed Trump. So this idea of, well, it's just, let's only talk about it through the realm of what the race is, what the gender is, that's just not accurate. And it's just excuse making. It's really hard for just your standard partisan loyalist hack Democrat to do self-criticism, to look in the mirror and go, hey, what, you know, how do we lose this? This should have been an easy election win. So what do? They obfuscate, they deflect, they rationalize, and it's all to avoid looking in the mirror to say, we got to ask ourselves some real questions here. What do we stand for? I mean, under Obama, he ran as like an anti-war president. Now we're doing seven interventions. We were doing seven interventions under him. Drone strikes killed 90% the wrong people. You know, he's a guy who promised, oh, yeah, NAFTA's bad, and he did trade deals while he was there. He signed trade deals. He did nothing on money and politics. Nothing. The guy who's going to fundamentally change the system and give people hope did nothing on money and politics. You know, sure, he did some things. Is some good things, of course. But there were a lot of things he did where it was just business as usual and politics as usual. And it wasn't fucking inspiring. So you have Obama pushing for half measures all day long. The incrementalism wasn't enough for people. And then you have Hillary come along and say, yeah, ditto. Status quo, business as usual, vote for me. There wasn't a bold populist left platform. She wasn't saying Medicare for all, let's do it now. Let's eliminate student loan debt. Let's get free college. Let's, make the minimum wage a living wage and tie it to inflation. Let's end the wars. Let's end the drug war. It was all just standard corporatist, centrist, fucking, you know, hey, half measures all day long. Don't you want to vote for me? And let's talk about how shitty the other guy is. It wasn't enough. So when your analysis boils down to, it's because she's a woman and it's because he was black, too much change for people, that's so convenient because it allows you to say, well, look, we don't really need to change anything substantively. It's those damn sexists and racists that need to fucking grow up and vote, shut up and vote for the right people. So it absolves you of any wrongdoing. It absolves you of all of it. Then you get to go, it's not us, it's them. And then I got some bad news for people like this. You're not going to shame people into voting for you. That's not a thing that happens where people go, oh, I've been sufficiently shamed, let me go do it. They're never going to learn, man. They're never going to learn. Talk about the issues. Talk about the issues. The Democrats could have a permanent majority if they just ran on the things that matter. There are so many single issues where if the Democrats said, you know what, let's go all in on that one, they would win. Single issues. You pick the fucking topic. Corporate tax dodging, you know. You go, well, I don't know, Kyle, that sounds pretty obscure. So fucking explain it to people. Did you know, because mega-rich multinational corporations dodge their taxes, the government is cheated of $450 billion of revenue every year, and they shift that burden onto you, the middle class. You have your taxes raised because corporations buy politicians and then dodge paying their fair share. We're going to put an end to that, and we're going to put an end to that on day one. We're going to fight for this fiercely. On that alone, boom, you win an election. Hey, did you know that if you work full-time, you don't make enough money to survive in America? You can work full-time and still live in poverty. That makes no goddamn sense at all. If you work full-time, you're doing your part for society. Shouldn't society do their part for you? Shouldn't you make a living wage? That's what we're going to fight for. That's what we're going to implement. Vote for us if you want that. That's what we're going to do. Hey, did you know we have a mass incarceration epidemic in this country? We jail more people than anybody else in the world, even China, and they have a population that's way larger than ours. Why? Because we're locking up nonviolent people for drug offenses. That's no different than taking your uncle who likes to drink gin and throwing him in jail. Should he be locked up in a cage and lose his freedom because he likes to tweak his consciousness slightly? How about we legalize marijuana and free all the nonviolent drug offenders? These are issues you can win on. Oh my God, it'd be so fucking easy to win if you just pushed for things that matter to people. That's it. 60% already want Medicare for all. And only like two or three prominent Democrats are going to push for it, where all the others do these mealy-mouthed defenses of Obamacare and just say Trump care is bad. It's like you're trying not to win. The Democrats could win and have a permanent majority if they ran on the right things. But as long as they keep deflecting and obfuscating and taking no responsibility and not looking inward, they're never going to do it. Okay. All right, it is break time, baby. When we come back, we're going to have a story that looks like it's from The Onion. And then we're going to have Alex Jones later on in the show. Oh, my goodness, the new conspiracy his guest floated. Wait until you hear it. Stay right there. We'll be right back. Let's go. You know you're not gonna lose now. You've been working hard.
you with the left, the left. I feel like I'm the left, real nigga left, the left. It's like I'm on an island by myself, the left.
All right, y'all, we back.
You with the left.
Quick program note, for the 4th of July, we're not here Monday, Tuesday. Wednesday will be Kyle and Corin like usual. And then Thursday, Friday, we're back live skis. So Monday, Tuesday, no show. Everybody enjoy your 4th of July. But we still got a lot of stuff to get through today, so let's get down to the business. So here's a story that looks like it's from The Onion. Afghanistan conflict, U.S. says troop withdrawal was too quick. What? We've been there 16 years. What do you mean? What do you mean it's too quick? Aren't we, like, tying some of the longest wars ever? There were ones that are longer, to be fair, but, like, 16 fucking years. Well, you drew down. You drew down too quick. That's what happened. Everybody agrees. Wait, they make that argument. Okay, so this is from BBC. They say, Mr. Mattis was briefing NATO allies on future strategy amid reports the U.S. will boost its military presence. His comments were in direct contrast to NATO's Secretary General, who said the withdrawal should have happened sooner. U.S. troops reached 130,000 in 2011, but were drawn down, leaving the Afghan military in control at the end of 2014. There are now 13,500 NATO troops there. Mr. Mattis was speaking at a press conference after meeting NATO defense ministers in Brussels. He said, looking back on it, it's pretty much a consensus that we may have pulled our troops out too rapidly, reduced the numbers a little too rapidly. Diplomatic and U.S. sources have suggested the number of U.S. troops could increase by between 3,000 and 5,000 to try to counter a resurgent Taliban and the presence of an Afghan branch of so-called Islamic State. Mr. Mattis said, I don't put timelines on war. War is a fundamentally unpredictable phenomenon. The bottom line is that NATO has made a commitment to Afghanistan for freedom from fear and terror, and freedom from terror demands that you can't let this be undone. The conflict in Afghanistan has dragged on for 16 years since the 9/11 attacks in the United States. Okay. Where do I begin with this silliness? Look, they just said troop levels peaked in 2011. 130,000 troops were there in 2011. Guys, that's already 10 years into the war. 10 years into the war. Obama escalated Afghanistan. People rarely talk about that. When he first came into office, giant escalation of Afghanistan. 130,000 troops in 2011. And then they were drawn down, and they bottomed out to 13,500 in the year 2014. So 13 years into the war, we limit the number of troops to still over 10,000. And Mattis goes, you know, it's basically like, you know, it's a general consensus. Everybody agrees. Everybody you talk to in your fucking military-industrial complex circles, everybody agrees we drew down too quickly, you know, 13 years into the war. It's like the old saying, 13 years and you're just getting started. You know they have a nickname for Afghanistan, right? It's called the Graveyard of Empires. I wonder why that is. Could it be because they get sucked into endless wars that you can't win in Afghanistan? Look at what we're doing, man. Are we really having this conversation in the year 2017? 16 years into the war, and they're like, you know, we have a new strategy. We're going to escalate troop levels. Well, so what? What are we supposed to believe? The 19th year is going to be a charm? The 26th year is going to be a charm? And then there's also some amazing admissions in there if you pay close attention to how everything is framed. Because it's very subtle, but he's dropping little hints like this. I don't put timelines on war. So what does that mean? What are you saying? I don't put timelines on war. The bottom line is NATO has made a commitment to Afghanistan for freedom from fear and terror. Freedom from terror demands that you can't let this be undone. hold on. The Taliban controls 40% of Afghanistan right now. You can't defeat them. That's not an option. It's a guerrilla army. There's no, you get, okay, we just got rid of the ones that exist now. There's going to be more that pop up. You can't win a war on terror. Terror is a tactic. So you have the Taliban in some parts. In eastern Afghanistan in some parts, you have ISIS now. It doesn't matter if we pull out now, if we pull out in 10 years, if we pull out in 100 years, as soon as we draw out, you're going to have the Taliban resurgent and taking over some territory. So what does that mean? So what are we going to do? In the mind of Mattis, he said, where is it? Wait for it. I don't put timelines on war. You know what that means? Permanent military occupation. The war in Iraq cost $7 trillion. The war in Afghanistan, at least $2 trillion. So we just waste all of our money there, taxpayer money, hard-earned taxpayer money. As our infrastructure gets a grade of D-plus here in this country, Flint doesn't have clean water. Half the country makes $30,000 a year or less. Yeah, go ahead. Just waste trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars in a war where there is no winning. Define winning for me. Ask anybody who still supports the war in Afghanistan, if you can find any, because they don't exist outside of Washington. Hey, what is winning? Define winning for me. When do you get to plant the flag and go, we did it? They won't have an answer for you. They won't have an answer. Why are we there? Notice they always move the goalpost. We got to get Osama bin Laden. We got to get, that's why we're going in. 01, we got to get Osama bin Laden. We just were attacked. Got Osama bin Laden. Okay, that's good. But Al-Qaeda, we got to get Al-Qaeda. There's less than 100 Al-Qaeda operatives in Afghanistan. Mission accomplished. No, we got to say get Al-Qaeda. Oh, we got Al-Qaeda? Okay, now we're the Taliban. We got to get the Taliban. That's what we got. We get the Taliban. Well, that's 40% of the fucking country they control. You're never going to defeat them. So it's an excuse to stay there. That's what it is, man. If you think our foreign policy is driven by wanting to give people freedom and democracy, just think about this for a second. The people who are our allies in Afghanistan have child sex slaves. That sounds like some Alex Jones type shit. No. This was widely reported. There was a U.S. soldier who blew the whistle on this and said, what do we do? We're teaming up with these warlords who have child sex slaves. He was discharged from the military for questioning our strategy. They said, no, you don't question them. It's a necessary alliance. It's an alliance of convenience. I mean, enemy of my enemy is my friend. The warlords are against the Taliban, so we gotta team up with them, give them weapons, give them money. That's the side you're going to fight on? And really, nobody should be surprised because we're allies with Saudi Arabia. All the horrific things they do, they say all atheists are terrorists, behead people in the public square for sorcery and witchcraft and drug smuggling. You know, look at all, it's not about human rights, it's not about freedom, it's not about democracy. So what's it about? What's it about? Military-industrial complex, war is very, very profitable for the people who buy the government. That's one aspect of it. And then the other aspect of it is, like every empire ever, natural resources. More power, more control. I mean, Iraq, the oil wealth there. Afghanistan, tremendous mineral wealth there, the opium crop. There's no good reason to still be there. Wasting our money, wasting our lives, killing their civilians. Already been there 16 years. We have a rogue government. By the way, only 17% of the American people support the war in Afghanistan, which means it's more unpopular than Vietnam. And that poll was taken in 2013. Imagine what it's like today as the war drags on and on and on and on and on. End the war, end it right now. All right. Let me do one more on foreign policy. How's this for an admission? Army General, U.S. military wasn't necessarily concerned about killing civilians in Iraq during the surge. Wow. We've always been told the opposite, huh? I know when I was raised, I was told the opposite. Oh, no, we're the good guys. We always look out for stuff like that. They're admitting it here. Now, you might, well, come on, but who is this person? It's only the Army's top general overseeing logistics in Iraq. The person who oversees logistics. So the person who's like, hey, I think there are civilians there. This is the person who's saying, we weren't necessarily concerned about civilian casualties. So this is Lieutenant General Andre F. Piggy. And this is according to Business Insider, quote, these high-tech munitions limit collateral damage, and we were not necessarily concerned about that at the height of the surge, Piggy said, according to a transcript on the AUSA website. Now in Mosul, we are absolutely concerned about that. Yeah, I'm sure. The statement is starkly different from the usual Pentagon messaging of always taking care to reduce civilian casualties. A 2003 American Forces Press Service article, for example, touted the use of precision-guided munitions that would reduce casualties in the Iraq war. The same article quoted then-Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld as saying the coalition would take great care to avoid them. Still, Piggy's statement seems a stunning explanation for the rise in civilian deaths during that time. Civilian deaths in Iraq went up by roughly 70% in 2007, according to the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs. Perhaps the most infamous example came in the release of the Iraq war logs by WikiLeaks, leaked gun camera footage taken by U.S. Apache helicopters in 2007, showed the pilots firing on and killing several civilians, including two Reuters journalists. A U.S. airstrike in March killed 105 civilians in Mosul, marking one of the deadliest days for civilians since the campaign to retake Mosul began in late 2016. A Pentagon investigation asserted that explosives placed in the building by ISIS was a major factor contributing to the death toll. Okay. So here's the deal. We actually shouldn't be surprised by this, because the evidence piling up and it's just kind of hidden from our eyes a little bit. If you read enough and you get the right outlets, then you'll see. So for example, on drone strikes, there are a variety of different kinds of drone strikes. There's personality strikes and signature strikes and double taps. Personality strikes is where we say, we know who we're getting. We have good intelligence and we're going to go after them. A signature strike is where they go, not really all that sure, but we're going to go after them. And double tap is when they circle around and kill the first responders. So circling around and killing the first responders is so common, they have a name for it. Think about that. Now, even under Obama, who's like widely regarded as, oh, come on, he's more reasonable and more moral than a guy like Trump, an unhinged buffoon. True. But even under Obama, 90% of the time, drone strikes got the wrong target. So, I mean, that's telling now, isn't it? That even under the more responsible president, that's what happened. And there are interviews with former drone operators who have fucking PTSD, and they're all fucked up, and they're talking about how, I did horrendous things. I mean, the culture inside these, among these drone operators is one where they're doing drugs. They'll kill fucking anybody. They say, whatever, we're cutting the grass. These are fun-sized terrorists. So that many people believe, I don't know what you mean. Of course, we're overwhelmingly concerned about civilian casualties. That's just the propaganda that we've been fed that a lot of people uncritically believe. I mean, if we were so concerned about civilian deaths, how could it be that there were minimum 200,000 deaths in Iraq, civilian deaths in Iraq? Man, you must be the clumsiest motherfuckers on the planet then, huh? We're so concerned about it, but oh, fuck, 200,000 civilians just died. Seems like you're not all that concerned about it. Now, I don't think they're trying to kill them on purpose, but it's just like they don't care. They just do whatever, file it under collateral damage. Yeah, whatever. We're trying to get ISIS or Al-Qaeda or the Taliban or whatever, depending on which conflict you're talking about. But, I don't know, there's a one Taliban commander in a room full of 12 civilians. Who cares? Pull the trigger. Freedom and democracy, human rights. That's not human rights. That's not human rights. And now you have the admissions. The top general overseeing logistics. Look, we weren't necessarily concerned about space. Oh, but we are now. Oh, my God, we are now. Really? Is that why we've been reading reports about how Trump is loosening the rules of engagement? He did it specifically in Somalia. You know, used to be, oh, okay, you're supposed to wait until theoretically somebody's looking like they're going to attack you or they fire on you, and then you're fine. They go, no, we can't fight politically correct wars. This is something Trump says, Ben Carson, other people on the right. Can't fight politically correct wars, you know? That, you know what that means? Forget international law, human rights. Are you there to do the job or not do the job? Just start going guns blazing, man. Going guns blazing. How many times did people say, carpet bomb the area? I want to see if sand can glow. That's something I think Ted Cruz said. We're using white phosphorus in Syria. In mostly civilian populated areas. So Raqqa, which is the capital of ISIS, but there's tens of thousands of civilians trapped there. We're using white phosphorus there. We're using uranium tips. That's illegal under international law. We don't give a fuck. On Trump's first military act as president, it was a raid where he managed to kill an 8-year-old American girl. If we were the freedom and democracy-loving, human rights-caring, you know, country that we've been told throughout our lives, we wouldn't be top allies with Saudi Arabia. We wouldn't be top allies with Israel. We wouldn't be doing shit like this, but we are. So we have to wake up from the collective delusion and actually try to hold our country accountable and make it so, first of all, we mind our business and we don't fight wars we don't need to fight. But if we do, it should be for self-defense, and we should actually care about human rights and freedom and democracy, but we don't. Okay. Now let's go to the Fox News doctor. Oh boy, is this a story. Oh, where you at, Fox doctor? There you go. It's going to be hard to break this one down because it's just so much bullshit. The Fox News doctor weighed in on the issue of healthcare and Medicaid, and he makes so many bad arguments that it honestly overwhelms me every time I listen to this short clip. So take a look here, and then I'm going to do my best to dissect it.
Well, Dr. Siegel, people keep saying, expand Medicaid. And you're saying, hold on, fix it first.
Because nobody's looked at that, Brian. 30% of doctors, like me, don't see new Medicaid patients. We know that it's impossible to work with. It's unwieldy. There's too many things with it, too many bells and whistles.
Especially with the expansion. If you didn't like it before, since 6 years ago when you got Obamacare, it's probably more of a challenge.
No disincentive for overuse, no copays, no deductibles. In states that have the Medicaid expansion, emergency room visits are up by 9%. Now, hospitals like that because patients that used to be uninsured now have their Medicaid card, but they're flocking into the ERs to get services they don't often need. Did you know, Brian, that 15% of Medicaid patients are prescribed an opioid every year? Now, that's the doctor's fault for overprescribing, but Medicaid allows doctors to overprescribe. And that's one of the secret stories that we're breaking right now, is that the opioid epidemic is tied to Medicaid as an enabler. Doctors are the problem. Medicaid is enabling it.
So, Dr. Siegel, if I put you in charge of fixing it, where do we start?
Well, I'd scale it back to basic services. What does a person really need? Look, there's a lot of disabled patients, a lot of children that are on Medicaid. There's people that really poor people really need Medicaid. But do they need a wheelchair every 2 years? I don't think so. I want to scale back the excess. And then, as Medicaid Director Seema Verma has said quite smartly, let's have premium buy-ins in the Medicaid expansion states for services beyond what you need.
What is
how about a bridge to jobs?
Sorry, can you tell me, what does that mean?
It means if you want more than the basic services.
Okay.
And you have some income. Okay. We're talking about the Medicaid expansion states.
Yeah.
Then you can pay a premium to get more than you would just freely be given. And also, we need bridge to jobs programs in the Medicaid expansion states, because people that don't have jobs, Brian, get their Medicaid card and they say, I don't want to give it up. I don't want to give up that Medicaid because I can't afford to take that job. I won't get as good a health care. Now, I'm talking about Medicaid expansion states, and I completely understand that the bill wants to peel that back. I get that, but I predict that a compromise will have to occur.
Okay. There's so much bullshit there that I don't know if I could break it all down, but I'm going to try. So at the end, he says, there's a problem. You know, if they get a job, oh, I'm going to lose my Medicaid. What am I going to do? I don't want to do that because then I lose my good health care. Okay, but wait, then you were just arguing Medicare isn't good health care, but now you're saying people want to keep their Medicaid because they want to avoid getting a job to get employer-sponsored health care, which is worse. So which is it? Is it good or is it bad? Okay, but he says, but he's arguing like, oh, you know, basically people on Medicaid don't have jobs. That's not true. Most people do. Most people on Medicaid have jobs. So that's not accurate. But furthermore, even if what he's saying was right, wouldn't that be an argument to not have employer-based health care? Like, oh, we have this terrible incentive because you're going to lose your health care if you go get a job. Yeah, so shouldn't it be that health care is a right in a modern society, and so you could go from job to job and not have to worry about losing your health care? Like, he's, again, accidentally making the case for single payer, even though he'd swear up and down that he's not doing that. Okay, and again, Medicaid bridge to jobs, let's have, implying that people on Medicaid don't have jobs. Most people on Medicaid do have jobs. Then he talks about premium buy-ins for more options. There's an amazing contradiction in there, because at the beginning he says, well, Medicaid, too many bells and whistles. They have too many bells and whistles. But wait, then you argue for premium buy-ins for more options, which is more bells and whistles. So which is it? Do you want the bells and whistles, or do you not want the bells and whistles? But we have the answer, because what are premium buy-ins? That's privatizing Medicaid. That's what he wants to do. He wants to privatize Medicaid. So, in other words, he talks about the bells and whistles in Medicaid being bad because Medicaid is government. But then at the same time, he says, wouldn't bells and whistles be great? But they're only great if you privatize it first. This is what we call an ideologue, guys. He has his answer. He'll make whatever the facts are and the circumstance fit into his answer. He's working backwards from his conclusion. That's what this guy's doing. Yeah, bells and whistles in Medicaid, oh, it's gross. Anyway, what we should do is have a system where you do premium buy-in so you can get bells and whistles. If they already have the bells and whistles, why do you need the premium buy-ins to get the bells and whistles? And then he says, oh, I love this argument because this is probably his dumbest argument. He goes, well, Medicaid, you know, it's fueling the opioid crisis. I'm surprised it's only 15% of Medicaid patients who have been prescribed opioids. You want to know why? Opioids are the go-to painkiller in every hospital because it kills pain. So if it's only 15% of people prescribed opioids that go in when they're on Medicaid, I'm amazed that I would have guessed it would have been over 50% because over – you know, you go to the hospital, it's usually because you're experiencing pain. So only 15%, that's amazingly low. And then he goes, it allows doctors to overprescribe, Medicaid does. No, anytime anybody visits a doctor, you're going to be putting the doctor in a position where they might overprescribe. So just increasing doctor appointments around the country, that's a good thing. But he would say, no, maybe it's a bad thing because then it allows doctors to overprescribe. So less doctor's appointments are a good thing? Oh, my God, this guy is such an idiot. And finally he goes, well, look, Medicaid, it's impossible to work with. That's funny because I have some of my best friends' parents are doctors. And when I've spoken to them, they say the exact opposite. They go, no. Medicare, Medicaid, it's easier to work with. The amount of paperwork and bullshit that goes into private health insurance companies is unbelievable. So I'm led to believe it's the exact opposite of what the scummy Fox News doctor is saying. Shock, shock. And notice there's one really telling moment in the middle of his rant as to why he thinks Medicaid sucks. He goes, there's no copays and deductibles. Yeah, that's something where the rest of us go, sign me up, please. The people love that. You might not like it as a doctor, but the people love it. I'm telling you guys, I listened to that clip like four times. I needed to listen to it four times to really absorb every single bullshit point he made, because everything that came out of his mouth, it was just verbal diarrhea. It was atrocious. It was all incorrect. It was incredibly misleading, and it was dumb. Okay. All right, let me take my final break, and then when we come back, we got Alex Jones, oh boy, and Christian pastors are going to make an argument as to why gay people don't exist. Oh, that's just funny. Okay, stay right there.
Bye. We are back, and I have an awesome video for you. This might be one of my favorite secular talk segments of all time, and I haven't even done it yet. Okay. Alex Jones had a guest on his show this week named Robert Steele, and they hatched the most glorious conspiracy of all time. Let's watch.
But you know, one of Hunter S. Thompson's best friends, he's the famous artist, I interviewed him, he said Hunter S. Thompson was about to expose pedophile rings and things, and that it was disinfo against him by the pedophile rings because he was writing about it. Let me see what Robert David Steele has to say. Go ahead.
Well, I agree with that, and let me just point out that pedophilia does not stop with sodomizing children. It goes straight into terrorizing them to adrenalize their blood and then murdering them. It also includes murdering them so that they can have their bone marrow harvested as well as body parts. Pedophilia is much
bigger. This is the original growth hormone.
Yes, yes. It's an anti-aging thing. And this may strike your listeners as way out, but we actually believe that there is a colony on Mars that is populated by children who were kidnapped and sent into space on a 20-year ride. So that once they get to Mars, they have no alternative but to be slaves on the Mars colony. There's all kinds of...
Look, I know 90% of the NASA missions are secret, and I was told by high-level NASA engineers that you have no idea. There's so much stuff going on, but then it goes off into all that. I mean, that's the kind of thing the media jumps on. But I know this. We see a bunch of mechanical wreckage on Mars, and people say, oh, look, it looks like, mechanics. They go, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist. Clearly, they don't want us looking into what's happening. Every time probes go over, they turn them off. Well, I don't know about Mars bases, but I know they've created massive thousands of different types of chimeras that are alien life forms on this Earth now.
That was tremendous. I loved it. I loved it. You know you've gone too far when Alex Jones is like, look, man, I don't know about Mars bases, but I do know, what the fuck is a chimera? I don't know what that is. What's a chimera? He says, alien life forms been created on this planet. So according to Alex Jones' guest, Mr. Steele, NASA is running a child slave colony on Mars where they fuck kids and then harvest their organs. So this is the world we live in now, guys. I just want all of you to understand this. This led to NASA responding with the greatest statement of all time. So this is from the Daily Beast here. It says, NASA denies that it's running a child slave colony on Mars. On Thursday, Alex Jones welcomed a guest to talk about how kidnapped children have been sent on a two-decade mission to space. NASA now denies the interplanetary conspiracy. What is life? What the fuck is going on, man? What is going on? Donald Trump, a reality star, silly person, is president. And Alex Jones is now prominent enough where if he's a lunatic in his own respect. With Sandy Hook is a hoax and all that shit. You got this guy on, and they have enough of a megaphone where NASA has to come out and be like, hey, wait, that's not true. Come on, we don't have a child slave colony on Mars. They're all adults. No, I'm kidding. What the fuck? You know, there are some people who listen to me and Alex Jones, and I need to figure out what I'm doing wrong because I don't want to have crossover fans with this guy. Go away. He's such a silly person. How do you have that guy on? Oh, I give up. Okay. Next. All right, let's move on from conspiracy crazy people to fundamentalist crazy people. Okay, where you at? Here we go.
There was a Christian conference in L.A. recently, and the Friendly Atheist got some video here of Pastor John MacArthur talking about homosexuality, and this is fun.
Holds on to Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior, however is gay, will he enter the kingdom of heaven, knowing that we are all sinners saved by grace?
Well, I don't know if it's for me, but no one is gay. If you mean by that, that's some hardwiring. No one is gay. People commit adultery, they commit sins of homosexuality, they lie, they steal, they cheat. That's like saying, you know, I keep robbing banks, but I'm a robber. I'm a bank robber. What am I going to do? I'm a bank robber. That is not an excuse for what you do. Are there certain kind of impulses that lead people in that direction? Yes. But I think one of the really deadly aspects of this is to let people define themselves as gay. They are not gay any more than an adulterer is hardwired to be forced by his own nature to commit adultery. Those are all sin. Those are all behavioral sins that are condemned in Scripture. God didn't hardwire anybody in such a way that they are not responsible for certain behaviors. And so we need to cancel that out of the sin list and welcome them into the kingdom of God because he can't do anything else. So I think we do no service to people who are caught in the vicious sins of homosexuality by letting them define themselves by that sin.
I think the thing that I love the most about this is, like, everybody, it's a room where everybody's, like, well-dressed, they're wearing their suits and ties, and they're sitting there all respectable. And then they float theories like, quote, no one is gay. The people in the audience are sitting there like, right. Why do people just say things that, like, plainly on their face are preposterous? Like, that is just a stupid-ass thing to say. No one is gay. Really? No one's gay? I could show you, you know, kids who you'll look at and go, I don't know, it might be gay. I mean, I'm just saying. So, really, how do you know? Nobody's hardwired. Well, is anybody hardwired to be heterosexual? For that, he'd go, of course. Yes. Of course, it's a natural order. Yes, people are wired to be heterosexual. So why is it so hard to believe that some people are wired to be homosexual? I mean, it happens in, like, a consistent number of the population throughout time. What other explanation is there? No, but the most interesting part of this really is that why do these guys make this argument?
No one's gay. No one is gay.
So what does that mean? In his mind, he's saying it's a choice, 100% a choice. So for the people who say it's a choice, here's the dirty little secret. They say that because it's a choice for them, because they're tempted by the cock. I have no doubt about it. Anybody who's ever argued that.
What do you mean? Nobody's gay. It's a choice.
It means, look, let's keep it real. If we all kind of want to do it, but the reason I'm not doing it is because I'm fighting the urge. See, it's a choice, and I'm choosing to fight the urge, because everybody has the urge, right? And I'm just choosing to fight it. Other people don't choose to fight it, and they're morally weak, the ones who actually do it. Me, I'm morally strong, and I'm fighting the urge. That's what really goes on in these guys' minds. And I feel bad for them. I really do. Because they've lied to themselves so thoroughly that they get to the point where they make statements that regular people laugh at. No one is gay. That's what he said. Really, nobody's gay. Nobody's gay. But he has to convince himself of these things to try to keep keep himself in the closet and to try to keep his own passions under wrap. But he, don't, man, just come out, enjoy your life. There's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing immoral about it. These are guys who are brainwashed by religion and they think, like, you know, that makes me a bad person if I do that. But what if it doesn't? What if it doesn't? And what if your religion isn't true? And what if you're just wasting your life beating back these passions that you have and that you're never going to get to experience? Well, to be fair, a lot of these guys do it anyway and then feel bad about it. But you don't need to. Don't feel bad about it. Okay, I'm done on this story, but no one is gay, said the genius pastor, as people in the audience said, right, nobody's gay. Okay, next, let's talk about California's right to die law. We have some facts available now about California's new right to die law, and I want to share this with you here. So Huffington Post explains, in California, 111 terminally ill people chose to exercise their right to end their own lives in the first 6 months after the state's right to die law went into effect, according to a report released this week by the California Department of Public Health. The End of Life Option Act, signed into law in 2015 and implemented last June, allows terminally ill patients who have been given a prognosis of 6 months or less to live can obtain a legal dose of medication, lethal dose of medication. According to data collected by the state, 191 people were prescribed aid in dying medication from June 9th to December 31st, 2016. Of those individuals, 111, 58%, died after taking the prescribed medication. Of the remaining individuals, 21 died without taking the drug. No outcomes were reported for the other 59 people. About 75% of the people who died after taking the medication were 60 to 89 years old. Nearly 90% of them were white, and 72% had attended at least some college. So, under the law, two doctors must sign off on the patient's prognosis, and the patient must make a written request and two oral requests for the medication at least 15 days apart, and patients must also be deemed capable of making decisions about their own health. So it is a very highly regulated thing that's going on here. And again, it only applies to terminally ill patients. And this is the minority of states that have this. There are a few other states, I don't know if it's four or five or six other states, that have right to die laws in place, but most states still don't have it. So you could be terminally ill, an incredible amount of pain, and you could say, look, I want to go peacefully. And they tell you to fuck off. Or legally, they can't allow you to do that. So, interesting numbers on this, but I think the most important point here is it busts up some myths. So one of the myths was, well, if you legally allow it, what's going to happen is doctors are going to give it as an option to poor patients as an alternative to expensive treatment. And that just didn't happen. So now you can say, hey, it's a small sample size, 111 people. Fair enough. But at least to this point, it hasn't happened. And all we've done is actually increase freedom and liberty. Politicians love to use those terms, very rarely think about what it actually entails to believe in freedom and liberty. Well, this is freedom and liberty. This is, I'm going to decide my own fate, my own life, and what's going to happen. And in instances where you're terminally ill and in excruciating pain all the time, yeah, that should be an option. It should be out there where you want to go peacefully. And by the way, you can be surrounded by your loved ones. And, of course, it will be a sad thing. Hey, we're saying goodbye, all that stuff. But you know what? When you're terminally ill, that's a preferable situation, at least in my opinion. And you don't have to do it. Nobody has to stumble across you, you know, when you pass away on a random morning and they're not expecting it. And it's an even bigger shock to the system. You could have your loved ones around you and all that stuff. So to me, this, it doesn't even seem like a very debatable issue. Like, Are you in favor of freedom and liberty and people making their own decisions about the most private personal matters or not? And, of course, who fought this? The Catholic groups in California fought this law. Compassion and love, and yeah, so you should be in excruciating pain because something life. We believe in life. So a bunch of myths were busted up here, and this is a model that the rest of the country should adopt because I think it's the right thing to do. And unfortunately, in most states, we don't have these kinds of laws. Okay. Now, let's move along. Let me show you how other nations' cops handle tense situations. There's a police officer in Thailand named Anirudh Mali, and he was able to talk down a man with a knife who was threatening people. This is an incredible story. I have a short video here on it. Let's watch. Desperate man entered a Bangkok police station with a large knife. I'm reading it for you here. Instead of reaching for his gun, police officer Anirudh Mali did this. He sat down and started talking to the attacker and calmly convinced him to hand over his knife. Then something very unexpected happened. Anirudh gave the attacker a big hug. He gave up the knife. The distressed 45-year-old seemed to show remorse immediately. So the officer calmed him down and gave him some water. He used to be a musician, but had been working as a security guard for 3 days and had not been paid. On top of this, he had his guitar stolen and was all stressing him out. I heard him out and sympathized and said I had a guitar to give him and suggested we go out for a meal together. The unnamed attacker was taken to a hospital for mental health care checkup. No charges were filed. That's wild. So first of all, that requires a tremendous amount of poise to, like, sit there while a guy has a gun, or not a gun, excuse me, a knife, and it's pointed at you. He's in a threatening pose with it. And he just sits there. He's like, look, man, let's talk this out. What's bothering you, dude? You're not mad at me, you know. I didn't do anything to you, so talk to me. What's happening? And he's able to convince the guy to give up the knife, gave him a big hug. No charges were filed. Damn. And look, I mean, the bottom line is he, like, treated this person as a person, even though the person was acting in a very threatening way. And, you know, he basically, he looked at it, like, logically and said, well, something happened in this guy's life where he just snapped and he's super stressed out. And it's possible to talk the person down from the edge here. And he did. Not only did he do it, but afterwards, the guy was like, oh, what was I thinking? I'm so stupid. There's no way this story unfolds like this in the U.S. No way. Because we're not, officers in the U.S. are not, there's not an emphasis on de-escalation tactics. So as a result of that, these situations escalate oftentimes, and people end up dead. So, credit to this guy, man. That really is a hero cop, and he did the right thing. And, yeah, I mean, I would venture to say in most situations where you have people who snap, there is probably getting through to them if you have the right tactics. There are going to be some instances where people are kind of too far gone, and they're violent, and they're just going to be violent. Like, we know that that exists in the world. We know that there are some people who have the capacity to show zero remorse and to do the most hideous things and stuff. So that exists. But, you know, it's best to have trained officers who can gauge the situation and who can kind of get a feel for, is this one of those people or is it not? And most people, I think, can be kind of talked down off the ledge or the edge, ledge, whatever. You know what I'm saying. So very happy ending to this story. And that really is a hero officer. Okay, now, final story of the day. And it is on what is happening in Kentucky. Kentucky just switched up their public school curriculum. Look at this. Kentucky's Republican governor on Tuesday signed a new bill into law that will allow public schools to teach the Bible as part of their social studies curriculum. The idea that we would not want this to be an option for people in school, that would be crazy, reported Republican Governor Matt Bevin claimed at the bill signing. I don't know why every state would not embrace this, why we as a nation would not embrace this. The ACLU of Kentucky vows to monitor the situation. You could be an atheist, and you would appreciate there's a lot of wisdom in the Bible, Governor Bevin suggested. Last December, Governor Bevin officially proclaimed that 2017 is the year of the Bible in Kentucky. Governor Bevin's plan to respond to a violence epidemic in Louisville's troubled West End is roaming prayer groups. Yeah, we discussed that story. The guy's solution to crime is to just have a lot of people get together and pray. I'm not kidding. That's real. We covered the story. Unbelievable. Now, let's address some of his points. He said, well, look, even if you're an atheist, you can say there's a lot of wisdom in the Bible. Sure, turn the other cheek. You know, there's other parts in there that are happy-go-lucky parts. The parts you ignore, by the way. Those are the parts that you don't believe in and don't abide by. But there's also a lot of crazy shit. There's genocide. There's slavery. There's rape. That he would not acknowledge. Well, he was, the Lord works in mysterious ways or something, so it's okay. And look at how, like, what's amazing to me is how culturally brainwashed he is. Because he's having a very hard time being objective about this and putting himself outside of his Kentucky situation and circumstance and how it was when he grew up. Because, again, listen to the phrasing here. The idea that we would not want this to be an option for people in school, that would be crazy. Why is that crazy? To not teach the Bible in social studies class, why is that crazy? Why is it crazy to not teach religion in social studies class? Because in his mind, he thinks, what do you mean? This is the key to everything. This is what you follow. And this is like, this is good. The Bible's good. Okay, big guy, but you do know we're a secular nation, right? We're a secular nation, First Amendment of the Constitution. Well, then, by your own logic, if you're going to teach the Bible in social studies class, now you open the door and you got to teach the Quran in social studies class. Would not teaching the Quran be, quote, crazy, Governor Bevin? No, on that front, you go, no, of course we're not going to teach the Quran. What? No, oh, absolutely not. What are you talking about? Well, you just opened the door to teaching religious material in social studies class. And even if they do the dodge, the classic dodge, well, we're just teaching it as a historical. Well, first of all, you can't do that because that's so far back and the records are contradictory in terms of other documents at the time that that stuff isn't true. A lot of it is myths in the book. So you shouldn't be teaching that as a historical truism because it's not. But if you open the door to, well, we're just teaching it as a historical thing, well, then you have to allow for the Quran too. And you have to allow for the Book of Mormon. And you have to allow for the Bhagavad Gita. And you're not going to do that. So he's brainwashed by his own culture and his own situation and his own circumstance. And he can't see outside of it. So he thinks like, well, duh, we should teach the Bible like it's fact in a social studies class. And you're crazy if you don't want to do this. No, you're crazy. Because it's a holy book. It is a book of myths. You know, it's not factual what's in there. It's like teaching Mother Goose. You're worshiping Jigglypuff in space and now you're trying to impose that on public school students in social studies class. Hell no. I hope there's a lawsuit over this, and I hope the people on the side of secularism win, because we're supposed to have a separation of church and state, and this is clearly putting them together. Okay. All right, guys. That is it. I love you, and we will be back with Kyle and Corin on Wednesday. On Monday and Tuesday, we are off It is 4th of July, of course. So we are back on Wednesday with Kyle and Corin, Thursday back with the live show. And everybody enjoy. Hopefully you get some time off. If you do, enjoy your time off. I love all of you, and I'll talk to you soon. By the way, keep checking the YouTube channel because stuff will continue to upload while I am gone. It will continue to upload while we're off for those 2 days. So, all right, guys, love you, and we'll talk to you soon. Peace.